Hello and welcome to the Jacobites podcast, episode 10, Otrim. When we left Limerick, the Jacobites were preparing for an onslaught from King William's forces, who by this time had reached Caherconlish, a town just miles from Limerick. William has around 25,000 troops at his disposal, bolstered by troops fresh from a siege at Athlone, which was only lifted when the Williamites heard reports that Jacobite officer Patrick Sarsfield was ahead of the large relief force coming to the town. Sarsfield, as it happened, had started to hatch an even more radical and daring plan. In August 1690, a French defector from William's camp informed Sarsfield that, in his haste to get to Limerick, King William had ordered his men to ride ahead of their supply train, leaving it with a small escort of cavalry and over 5 days behind the main body of the army. This meant William's gunpowder, cannonballs, food, tools, coin, and engineers were all dangerously vulnerable to attack. Sarsfield realised this and began to sketch out an audacious plan to hit the convoy in a surprise attack. The rest of Limerick prepared for another assault, having rebuffed yet more terms of surrender from King William. The Duke of Tyrconnell, with the full intent of avoiding Sarsfield and his associates like the plague, was planning to leave the city with the cavalry to guard the banks of the River Shannon and fend off any Williamite attempt to block supply lines and besiege the beleaguered city. The Duke of Berwick, son to the former King James, advocated for the cavalry to conduct a harassment campaign against the Williamites, smashing towards Dublin, burning everything in sight, the theory being not to openly confront the enemy force, but distract them and sap their resources with hit-and-run tactics. This plan was, however, rebuffed by the Duke of Tyrconnell, much to Berwick's chagrin, who would later write bitterly of being happy to submit to his father, but furious at being lectured by one of the king's servants. Tyrconnell instead went ahead with his original plan of camping near Clare, leaving Limerick under the command of the Marquis de Boisselot, a French major general who'd fought with and commanded French forces at the Siege of Derry and the Battle of the Boyne. He was an experienced operator when it came to sieges, and felt he could better King William if it came to a fight. He had 14,000 troops at his command, as well as the assistance of Patrick Sarsfield, the Luttrell brothers, John Wauchop, and Thomas Maxwell. In preparation for a long siege, Boisselot ordered a 4-mile exclusion zone around the city, within which all buildings were burnt to the ground to deprive the Williamites of any cover. King William's army arrived outside Limerick on August 8th, 1690, where they got a chance to survey the defences and hedgerows surrounding Limerick and engage in skirmishes with Jacobite patrols. William, in a bid to end the fight quickly, ordered an all-out attack the next morning to try and dislodge the Jacobites from one of their last garrisons. As dawn broke on August 9th, Williamite troops edged through the hedgerows, seizing two forts on Singland Hill, overlooking Limerick. Employing a fighting retreat, the Jacobites would launch a single concentrated volley of musket fire and then fall back to the next hedgerow or barricade, eventually making their way to the earthwork defences around the city. As the Williamites came closer to Limerick's walls, they fell within range of the Jacobite cannons, which unloaded upon them, killing several and forcing the two sides to fight to a standstill. William decided to press what advantage he thought he had, and sent a messenger to Limerick to again present terms of surrender. The Marquis de Boisselot, still in a fighting mood, decided to try and engage a little trolling of King William, sending a response only to Robert Southwell, the king's personal secretary. In this letter, Boisselot refused to recognise William as king, instead saying he wished to prove the Prince of Orange that he could do a respectable job defending his city. Southwell was not best pleased to receive such a letter, predicting that Boisselot may change his tune once King William's siege guns arrived. As this war of words continued, Sarsfield rode to meet Tyrconnell at his camp near Clare and shared with him his plan to attack William's supply convoy. Even though these two men fought for opposite purposes at times and distrusted each other intensely, Tyrconnell clearly couldn't see the harm in trying and authorised a force of 600 men to accompany Sarsfield, albeit with minimal supplies. The attack party rode out of camp and across the Irish countryside, evading William's patrols along the way. As King William awaited the arrival of his supplies, and most importantly, his artillery, a local farmer arrived at the camp, claiming to have seen 600 Jacobite cavalry travelling between Limerick and Tipperary. Whilst not certain of this information, King William sent orders for scouts to recon the area, but there was an almost inexplicable delay between the order being given and the final deployment of any scouts. By the time the scouts left, however, it was too late. Sarsfield's raiders had charged into the Williamite camp on August 11th, catching the convoy and its escort completely by surprise. Sarsfield's men cut a swathe through the camp, its men, and the supplies, They then used the Williamites' own gunpowder to attempt to destroy William's siege cannons. In a freak incident, the powder blew the cannons away from each other, so that only two were actually destroyed, but the Jacobites had laid waste to everything else. Sarsfield had succeeded in one of the most audacious actions in the whole Jacobite campaign. With next to no supplies, William's army may seriously have to consider a general retreat. Jacobite morale was greatly boosted by this victory, and William's only solace in this was that six of his siege cannons survived the attack and made their way to Limerick by August 16th, at which point they were put to use bombarding Limerick with artillery. The citizens hid in terror as heavy rounds and firebombs were put to use, creating fires that ravaged the city's buildings. On August 20th, after feeling his artillery had softened the city up, King William put into motion the next phase of his assault, launching his grenadiers as shock troops against the earthworks around Limerick. The infantry of both sides slogged it out in the no man's land between Limerick's walls and William's camp, with both sides raining down artillery fire. Some Williamite cannon were moved to the earth forts near the walls, but after heavy rain dampened the fuses, it bought the Jacobites a few days of reprieve. By August 26, however, cannon fire resumed to the point a breach was made in Limerick's eastern wall. The next day, William launched an all-out attack with grenadiers and cannons. As Limerick's citizens fled, Boisselot tried to arrange his forces into a last-ditch defence of the Irish town section of the city. A fellow Frenchman, Lieutenant Colonel de Beaupré, charged towards the Williamite lines, who defied orders to stay in order and were attacking the city in complete disarray. In the grueling battle that followed, the Williamites were said to have lost 2,000 men, whilst the Jacobites lost 500, including the brave de Beaupré. As artillery tried to break the town, eventually William's men fell back to their camp. The Jacobites had managed to fight off King William himself. King William's own mood had soured considerably, and he was holding a war council debrief come post-mortem when it was decided that the king would make plans to withdraw to England. The Jacobites awaited the impending second wave for 2 days before looking over the walls to see the Williamites had disappeared, taking anything of value with them and burning the rest. The Jacobites allowed themselves a brief celebration, but trouble was coming elsewhere in Ireland. Queen Mary had contacted her husband with a plan from the Duke of Marlborough to launch a second front, the Queen sending her letter before William had tried to besiege Limerick. William gave his blessing to the plan, and by mid-September, Marlborough and his men set sail. Arriving near Cork on September 22nd, they punched through the Jacobite defenders, seizing Cork on September 28th and capturing the Jacobite forces there, before moving south and taking Kinsale and the Charles Fort, which secured the southern coast of Ireland for King William and limited Jacobite options for obtaining supplies. As if to add to the Jacobite troubles, intrigues and internal squabbling again sought to rip the command structure of William's forces to shreds. Just before Marlborough's landing, Tyrconnell had departed Ireland to France, ostensibly to lobby Louis for more guns, troops and money. As he left, Tyrconnell assembled a 12-man commission to govern and oversee Ireland in his absence, grudgingly including his rival Patrick Sarsfield. The Duke of Berwick was also promoted, as he was named Commander-in-Chief of the Jacobite Army. The ruling council was foundering under deteriorating conditions of Limerick and Galway, and numerous desertions of soldiers. Sarsfield and his allies were more focused, however, on Tyrconnell's sojourn to Versailles. They believed the old Duke was going to try and spin things to portray himself in the best possible light. Sarsfield's faction in the Jacobite army decided to send their own delegates to challenge Tyrconnell's narrative, but the old Duke was a step ahead, arriving in France just as news reached the palaces of Versailles and Saint-Germain of the defence of Limerick by Jacobite forces. Tyrconnell was greeted warmly by James Stuart and Mary of Modena, and even though War Minister Louvois had lobbied against what he felt as the waste of more resources in Ireland and returning focus to Europe, King Louis still supported the Jacobite campaigns in Ireland and held a private audience with Tyrconnell, promising support, but to what level was not made entirely clear. When Tyrconnell's adversaries arrived in France, they were in for a shock. Threatened with arrest for disloyalty to the government, Sarsfield's party discovered the Duke of Berwick had sent Thomas Maxwell ahead of them, not only to give Tyrconnell the heads up, but also brief James on the rebellious defiant forces within his own army. James had initially refused to see the delegation, but eventually relented and granted them an audience, during which their men claimed that Tyrconnell was old, infirm, and not qualified for command of an army, with a bluntness and directness that was uncharacteristic of talking about a viceroy, least of all to the monarch that viceroy works for. Queen Mary of Modena informed the delegates that if the king and queen were happy with their viceroy, that should suffice for their subjects. But once again, James was having yet another bout of second-guessitis. Fearing the possibility of looking weak to the French if he dismissed Tyrconnel, whilst at the same time fearing mutiny from the Irish if he didn't, James instead agreed to the proposed compromise of appointing a French officer to overall command of the Jacobite forces. It really speaks volumes at this point that the Irish officers, who were no fans of the French at all, were willingly choosing to be commanded by a French officer than opposed to be led by the Duke of Tyrconnel. As both sides of the conflict began to settle into winter quarters, defences were maintained, but the day-to-day life of camp had begun to take hold. With the Williamites, King William announced his intention to leave his forces in Ireland and travel to The Hague to finalise a deal with the Duke of Savoy, who'd defected from his cousin King Louis of France to join the Grand Alliance in Europe. Before leaving, King William urged Parliament to continue supplying funding for the war and opened back-channel negotiations for a formal cessation of hostilities. But peace talks were shut down by Sarsfield the minute he found out about them, and Parliament planned to take the land seized from Jacobite rebels and sell them on the open market to claw money back from the war, as opposed to William's plan of gifting them to allies and friends. The issue of confiscated Jacobite lands and what to do with them was going to drag on for years, and will probably get mentioned later, but for now, opinion was divided. In the Jacobite camp during the winter break, Tyrconnel returned with money, muskets, and a formal patent from James declaring Patrick Sarsfield the Earl of Lucan. When Sarsfield and Tyrconnel met in February of 1691, they weren't in open warfare against each other, but they neither agreed on policy, nor became friends, or even trusted each other to any major degree. The Jacobites idled in camp until May 1691, around the same time the Williamite regime in Dublin was enacting the Edict of Queen Mary to purge all the laws passed by the 1690 Patriot Parliament from the statute books, when French ships began to arrive with French officers, muskets, horses, cannon, and a fearsome new French commander called Charles Chalmont, the Marquis de Saint-Roch. Saint-Roch had a reputation as a hard fighter, not afraid of getting his hands dirty, given that he'd thrown himself into the persecution of the Protestant Huguenots on the orders of King Louis. Given that he commanded a troop of Irish soldiers in Savoy at the same time, it was felt Saint-Roch was a good fit to lead this next phase of the battle against King William. Despite their supplies and formidable commander, however, the French had brought no actual funds or soldiers, meaning while support from Paris seemed abundant, logistical support clearly had a limit. The Williamites began their new campaign season in earnest, with King William and his commander of the Dutch Blue Guards departing for mainland Europe. This left Godard van Reed, Baron von Ginkel, in charge of Williamite forces in Ireland. Ginkel was keen to perform well in what was his first command of an army, but he already had to contend with losing experienced commanders such as Meinhard Schomberg, son of the late Duke of Schomberg who was killed at the Battle of the Boyne, Schomberg being deployed to Scotland. Generals Kirk and Douglas were also taken to Flanders to fight with William's forces on the continent against the French. Now, so as not to leave Ginkel completely out of pocket, there were new arrivals in the form of English Major General Thomas Tolmash and Scottish Major General Hugh Mackay, arriving from operations where we saw him last time against Jacobite forces in Scotland during 1689 and 1690. Ginkel was eager to get the army moving again after its winter slumber and moved on to the fort at Ballymore in June, taking it from the Jacobite garrison on June 8, 1691. 800 Jacobite soldiers were taken prisoner, with their wives and children turfed out into the countryside. Ginkel had his sights set on the strategically vital city of Athlone, but he had to wait 10 days for his pontoon bridges, cannons and reinforcements. They set out and arrived on the outskirts of Athlone on June 19th, beating Saint-Roch and these reinforcements by 2 days. By the time Saint-Roch arrived, the Williamites had taken half the town and were kept at bay by a small stone bridge, which the Jacobites had reinforced defences around. The Duke of Tyrconnel arrived to oversee things, but the mood of his men had turned so nasty upon seeing him, some had still remembered his desire, in their eyes, to capitulate to the enemy. Several soldiers began talking of a petition demanding his expulsion, with one saying so directly to Tyrconnel's face and threatening to destroy his tent to ensure he could not stay in camp. Tyrconnel was aghast at this insubordination and complained to Saint-Roch, who did nothing. Tyrconnel could see his position was no longer tenable with the armed forces, who were now clearly under the command of this new French officer. Tyrconnel packed up, turned back towards Limerick, and rode away, disgusted and nursing his ego. From 5 a.m. on June 22nd, 1691, Ginkell's forces began a continuous artillery bombardment against Jacobite positions in Athlone. This continued for 9 days straight and consisted of cluster bombs, mortar shells and fire bombs, which wrought havoc on the thatched roofs of the city, with Williamite snipers killing any Jacobite they saw trying to fight fires in the town. St. Drew ordered his men, many of whom were raw recruits from Ireland, to hold the bridge. On June 27th, Ginkell tried his luck, sending soldiers to put planks down for a bridge and opening fire on the Jacobites to prevent them coming out of cover to sabotage the bridging efforts. The next day, the Jacobites, roused by one of their own who ran forward and was cut down trying to tear up the planks, held their line and retook the bridge. Ginkell was starting to lose faith in the mission until a Jacobite defector told him of Lewin's Ford, a knee-deep river crossing south at the bridge at Athlone. Ginkell planned a surprise attack on June 29th, but the pontoon bridge he was constructing took too long, and the Jacobites, having spotted the plot, successfully repulsed the attack. 24 hours later, on June 30th, Ginkell ordered 2,000 grenadiers to attack the walls of Athlone after receiving intelligence that St. Drew had rotated the guard assignments and currently had the most inexperienced Irish troops defending the walls. Wading across the river in lines of 20 men, they gave battle to the defending Irish troops, who fled. In the ensuing panic, the Williamites steamrolled the Jacobite resistance, butchering soldiers as they fled. Ginkell's men managed to take the city in roughly 30 minutes. St. Drew was left aghast as his deputy, Lieutenant General Dusson, was nearly trampled to death in the confusion. Nearly 500 Jacobites were lost in the fighting, compared to a claimed 13 in the Williamite army. Jacobite supplies, cannons and mortars were also lost to the enemy. The Jacobites then fell back to Ballinasloe, while smarting at such a vicious loss. Ginkell cleared what was left of Athlone and then issued a declaration on July 9th that offered any soldier who surrendered equal pay and rank in King William's army, provided that officer also surrender any town, fort or men they controlled to the king as well, within a 3-week time limit. There were also provisions for land retention and religious liberty, but the problem was that Parliament had watered down the language to such a degree it was ambiguous enough to be meaningless, much to Ginkell's chagrin. He was hardly surprised that anybody took him up on his offer, and no one did. So he headed westward with his men to seize Galway. St. Drew, meanwhile, had started to plot his next move. In a Jacobite war council, Sarsfield argued that given the immense size and firepower of Ginkell's army, taking them head-on was suicidal. He advocated instead for a guerrilla campaign to target Ginkell's supply lines in hit-and-run attacks. For once, and possibly the only time in recorded history, Tyrconnell agreed with Sarsfield. This is especially ironic, given as the plan is nearly identical to that proposed by the Duke of Berwick before the Battle of the Boyne, which Tyrconnell had vetoed. Whilst Dusson and Wauchop were sent to defend Galway and Limerick respectively, St. Drew scouted County Galway and found a castle and steep hedgerows near Kilcommodan Hill, all of which were situated near the village of Otrim. It was here, with its narrow road and natural defensive hedges, stream and bog marsh, that Ginkell's army arrived on the morning of July 12, 1691. Unable to go around the Jacobite force, and observing the Jacobite force in its posturing on Kilcommodan Hill, Ginkell surmised the Jacobites were digging in for an all-or-nothing stand and a show of defiance. Both sides were fairly matched numerically, with Ginkell holding advantage in number of horsemen and possessing cannon of a much larger calibre. He arranged his men in parallel to the Jacobites and deployed his artillery to support a general assault. At the war council beforehand, Hugh Mackay advised against marching straight at the Jacobites, and proposed instead to try and attack and roll up the enemy's right flank. As the Williamites began to push forward, they were bogged down by Sarsfield, who'd reinforced his part of the hill, preventing further advance, and in some places even gaining ground from Ginkell's men. Eventually, the Jacobite force had to withdraw, but it had rendered the Williamite left unable to attack. Ginkell started preparing for a long fight, ordering baggage and tents to be brought up, but Mackay spoke again, voicing the opinion of several officers that the best option was to attack right away and press any advantage of numbers and munitions. All credit to Ginkell here, he didn't pull rank and override Mackay, but instead heeded the advice of the Major General and endorsed Mackay's plan to attack the bridge fording Tristan Stream, as well as launching similar attacks along the line to probe the Jacobite defences and look for weak points. Seeing this, St. Drew took the bait Mackay offered and reinforced the bridge, moving troops from the other areas around Otrim. As the Williamites began their new assault on the bridge dividing the forces on Kilcommodan Hill, a flanking movement started on the Williamite left, but became pinned down by Jacobite sniper fire from the maze of hedgerows, which required painstaking fighting hedge to hedge to clear, thereby slowing the Williamite advance. Other troops made their way gradually across the boggy marsh and to the base of the hill, looking for a way round, but Saroux was pleased that the hedgerow snipers were slowing the Williamite advance. From his position high on the hill, Saroux predicted that Ginkell, with his reputation for caution, would retire and strike camp for the night, resuming his attack in the morning. The Jacobite commander prepared to hold his positions, but uncharacteristically, Ginkell decided to roll the dice and risk another attack. Soldiers were sent across the bog to screen the movement of horses and men to the left flank and to cut off any support from Otrim village. Major General Mackay led his infantry into battle, supported by the Williamite artillery. It was a hard advance, often waist-deep in marshes, before Mackay regrouped his bedraggled troops by the hedgerows. As the battle commenced, the Jacobites began to start a fighting retreat, but remained confident that with one push they could sweep Ginkell's forces from the field. The Jacobite infantry swarmed the Williamites, who began to fall back in areas and push forward in others. Ginkell feared the fight would be lost, but Tolmash rode into the fray and rallied some of the fleeing forces to resume their assault. As the battle began to grind to a stalemate, Mackay reconnoitred a nearby hill. After finding no volunteers to do so, and even after a fall from his horse, walked alone back to camp, roused his men to fight, and the cavalry ran the causeway to Otrim village, screened by the infantry deployment. Riding into almost point-blank fire from the Jacobites in the village, the cavalry rushed in and began their attempt to take Otrim castle. Saroux was keen to ride himself and smash the Williamites off the field and blaze a trail to Dublin, but instead rode to the Jacobite artillery battery to oversee their fire. In an awful bit of luck, this battery was being targeted at that very moment by Ginkell's cannons, which launched a volley. As the smoke cleared and the Jacobite cannon crew assessed the damage, they looked to see Saroux slump and fall from his horse. Then discovering a stray cannonball had hit Saroux and taken his head clean off. In a hasty bid not to let anyone see, the commander's body was hastily concealed, just as the Williamites began to take Otrim village and its Jacobite defenders fell back. Du Tessier, in a bid to maintain control, charged the Williamite lines, but was himself shot and wounded before being dragged from the field. Patrick Sarsfield, the Earl of Lucan, became the third Jacobite commander of the day almost by default. However headstrong Sarsfield was, he knew a losing battle when he saw one. He thought the best bet for the Jacobites now was to withdraw and preserve as many men as he could to fight another day. Several Irish officers sacrificed themselves in the retreat, fighting on to the death rather than surrender. The Jacobites were pursued by Ginkell's army till darkness began to fall, at which point they fell back to Saroux's camp to loot it and take prize regimental banners and colours, which were presented to Queen Mary. The Battle of Otrim broke the last major Jacobite force. By no means had it been a guaranteed victory, but the defeat of Saroux and his forces opened the road to King William's army to march to Limerick or Galway. But the Jacobites weren't finished and still had the potential to offer spirited resistance. Ginkell rested his army in camp on July 13th, with prayers of thanksgiving being said for the army and King William. On July 14th, 1691, Ginkell set off with his army for Galway, the last port in Jacobite hands. Arthur French, the mayor of Galway, sent his emissaries to Ginkell on July 15th, eager to avoid the fates of Derry and Athlone. At the same time, Galway requested supplies from Limerick, but Sarsfield and Tyrconnell both refused, preferring that Galway hold out for the new French supplies that would arrive. The only problem with this was that Louis XIV had only promised food and ammunition, with the potential of troops coming in 1692. Arriving in Galway on July 19th, Ginkell offered terms of surrender, and the Jacobite military commander, Henry Dillon, played his part in refusing them at first instance. Ginkell, then using the tactic of cannons and grenadiers, launched a diversionary attack, sending Hugh Mackay and his cavalry north to the city walls overnight, cutting off any relief forces and leaving Galway feeling encircled. Galway finally capitulated formally to Ginkell on July 26th, with the Jacobite garrison being allowed to march out of town to Limerick, and Ginkell, in a bid to win hearts and minds, appointed Sir Henry Bellasis, a prominent Catholic officer in the English army, as military governor of the port town before heading to Limerick. In Limerick itself, Tyrconnell wrote to King Louis and James, informing them of the outcome of Outram, which James is reportedly said to have reacted to with a resigned shrug. Tyrconnell had desperately hoped to fight a guerrilla war against the Williamites, but this was dashed following the surrender of Galway, leaving Limerick to fight on virtually alone. Tyrconnell was then left enraged at the discovery Sarsfield's ally, Henry Luttrell, had inadvertently hinted to Williamite soldiers the Jacobites might consider terms of surrender, which was confirmed when Sarsfield read a letter addressed to Luttrell found on a Williamite messenger. Luttrell was acquitted at trial, so Tyrconnell did not get to see him hang, but he did not let him out of prison. Instead, Tyrconnell ordered a mass mobilisation of forces in Limerick, intending to fight to the end. On August the 10th, Tyrconnell dined with D'Usson in Limerick and was merry and jovial by all accounts, but retired to bed complaining of feeling unwell. The next morning, Tyrconnell could not be roused from his bed and was talking incoherently. The modern clinical consensus is Tyrconnell must have suffered a massive stroke during the night. Richard Talbot, the Duke of Tyrconnell, lasted a few more days before dying on August 14th, 1691. He was by no means the most liked or the most honest man, but he was a powerful politician, and without his presence, the Jacobites lost a shrewd and cunning manipulator and a very capable political operator for the days ahead. On August 25th, 9 days after Tyrconnell's death, Ginkell's army arrived at Limerick and began to dig in. The remaining Jacobite men tried to coordinate a new campaign while simultaneously fighting with each other. Ginkell heard talk of support coming from France and was instead determined to hit hard, fast and decisively to end this before it could happen. He launched a full artillery bombardment from August 30th, 1691, whilst Williamite ships sailed up the Shannon to bombard Limerick from the water. Firing on Thomond Bridge and the rooftops of Limerick to maximise damage and chaos in the city, the plan was to force the Jacobites to surrender before French relief forces could arrive. Hopes of this were dashed when a messenger arrived in camp on September 6th, informing Ginkell Limerick would not surrender. 2 days later, Ginkell moved his artillery closer and started bombardment of the city that would last for 2 weeks. Houses and city walls were battered to pieces in the process. On September 16th, the Jacobite dragoons were taken completely by surprise to find a pontoon bridge had been built to their camp outside Limerick, and they were routed by Williamite forces. Ginkell then gave the city 8 days to surrender or face the wrath of his army, with no quarter given. Inside Limerick, spirits finally started to break as the French reported back to Versailles that even Sarsfield was considering capitulation at this point. The fight worsened on September 21st when Sligo currently surrendered, leaving Limerick completely alone. Ginkell sent half his force to force a surrender. 2,000 Williamites versus 600-odd Jacobites meant the result was never really in doubt. The retreating Jacobites fled across the Thomond Bridge, creating a panic crush to enter the city. The French officer manning the gate pulled up the drawbridge, seemingly to prevent Ginkell's forces swarming the bridge and entering the city with the retreating Irish. Almost to a man, these forces were massacred by the Williamites, even as they tried to surrender, waving handkerchiefs in the air. The French and Irish blamed each other for the massacre, and had the French gatekeeper not been killed by a stray shot, he no doubt would have been torn to pieces or lynched by a furiously vengeful Irish populace. The slaughter on the bridge completely drained what was left of Jacobite morale, and on September 22nd, 1691, a drummer was sent to request parley and see to terms of surrender. A 24-hour ceasefire was called and the Lords Justices in Dublin were summoned. Sarsfield and Ginkell met, with Ginkell respectfully addressing Sarsfield as Earl Lucan and Sarsfield presenting Ginkell with bottles of claret. Formal negotiations commenced on September 27th, with the Jacobites requesting full terms of surrender, including pardons, indemnity, the restoration of all confiscated estates, and liberty and tolerance for the Catholics. Whilst Ginkell wasn't opposed to this in principle, he was not about to oppose the new legislature in Dublin, so he initially refused and final terms were agreed the next day. For such a protracted war, the cessation of hostilities was awfully quick and concise. The formal treaty to end the Williamite War in Ireland, called the Treaty of Limerick, was signed on October 3rd, 1691. Within its provisions, Jacobites were given the chance to join King William's army, join King Louis's army and sail to exile in France, or abandon fighting and hand in their weapons. Catholics would be free to practice, and William and Mary would convene a parliament to consider reforms. There were provisions for general pardons, provided people swore allegiance to King William and Queen Mary, and the treaty was ratified. On October 4th, the Williamite army entered Limerick, which was by now almost ruins. Even Major General Tolmash rolled up his sleeves to attempt to clear up the destruction left by the war. The Williamites started to loot from the Jacobites and steal from their camps, as well as the civilian dwellings within the city. The Jacobite army locked itself away to stay safe and prevent desertions. Ginkell and Sarsfield argued back and forth on this seclusion, but even after a personal appeal from Ginkell, only 6,000 Jacobites defected to the army, including Henry Luttrell, Sarsfield's ally. With hostilities over, Ginkell returned to Dublin on November the 3rd to a warm welcome. November the 4th, King William's birthday, was declared a national day of thanksgiving. Incidentally, for Henry Luttrell, his defection came at a price. He gained his brother Simon's confiscated Luttrell's town estates and became a Dutch major general, but in 1717 he was shot and killed in a sedan chair whilst being carried through Dublin in unknown and still suspicious circumstances. The remaining Jacobite forces had all departed by November. Men boarded ships bound for France, while some returned to civilian life with a small portion defecting to William's army. The Irish forces would arrive in the port of Brest before they were to be reassigned to King Louis's French forces. Stories made their way back to Ireland of the terrible conditions the men were subjected to, with the mayor of Brest providing no lodgings, clothes, or food to the new arrivals. Men slept by the roadside, and many wrote to those who'd not embarked yet from Ireland, imploring for them to stay at home. James Stuart sent a letter to his vanquished army on November 27th, 1691, telling them he was satisfied with the conduct of his Irish army and bidding them a fond farewell. It must have rung a hollow farewell from a king in name only. 12,000 Irish people left their homeland for France, some forfeiting land and noble titles in order to uphold their oath to their king, James Stuart, and also possibly to avoid future reprisals within Ireland itself. In January 1692, the new officials in Dublin swore their oaths of allegiance to King William and Queen Mary. In a beginning of reprisals, Catholics were purged from the army by the new Lord Justices, and many of the tolerances promised were unofficially put on the back burner. King William, revelling in the comfort of victory, drafted a proclamation that declared, "The said Kingdom of Ireland is reduced to our obedience, and the war and rebellion there ended. God save the King and Queen." Next time, we begin the first of our interludes between Jacobite campaigns. We will see how William and Mary reigned in England, Ireland and Scotland to consolidate their control following defeat of James Stuart and the Jacobite forces. And we will look on to the next chapter in our Jacobite saga.